This time we're on record in Ferguson versus Ferguson, and are there any preliminary matters by either party?
No, Your Honors.
None from us. Thank you.
Very well. You may proceed, Mr. Storer.
Thank you much, very much. My name is Dale Storer. I'm appearing on behalf of the plaintiff and appellant in this action, Mr. Michael Ferguson. This matter involves an irrevocable inter vivos trust created by Roger and Sybil Ferguson, originally in 1994. It was amended four times, and the particular version at issue here is a 2011 version. The parties in this case are, as I mentioned, Mr. Ferguson and three of his siblings who are acting as the successor trustees of the family trust in this particular matter. The original trust instrument provided for, had a provision that required that upon the death of the first grantor, that there would be an allocation between two trusts in the family trust, what I am going to refer to as the deceased grantor's share and the survivor's trust. In the 2011 version of the trust, included a provision which essentially disinherited Michael Ferguson along with his sister Debbie Priest, who is not a party in this matter. Roger Ferguson died approximately 6 months after the 2011 trust amendment was made, approximately a year and a half after Roger's death, Sybil executed a power of appointment pursuant to the terms of the trust, under the terms of which she then altered the dispositive share of the survivor's trust and made Mr. Ferguson a beneficiary under the of the survivor's trust. The allocation that I referenced earlier was essentially an allocation between the community and separate property of Mr. Roger Ferguson and Sybil, respectively. Sybil died approximately 1.5 years after she executed the power of appointment. Following her death, the parties had a number of meetings in which they discussed the administration of the trust. Essentially, the issue that they parted ways on is with respect to Michael's right to access the administrative records, primarily of the survivor's trust. And that is essentially the issue that is at before this court today. Approximately 1 year after Sybil's death, Mr. Ferguson filed this action, seeking again a court order requiring and allow him access to the trust administrative records. The parties continued to argue about the access to the administrative records. Ultimately, after 8 months of the litigation and still getting no success in obtaining access, Michael filed a petition for allowance of claim in Arizona. His mother resided in Arizona at the time of her death, and her estate was probated in Arizona. The reason for filing that the petition for allowance was to essentially toll a limitation period in Arizona with respect to any claims against the estate. Michael did not pursue any further proceedings in Arizona. By mutual stipulation of the parties, the matter was stayed.
Mr. Storr, talking about the facts for a moment, you mentioned that he had no success obtaining any trust records. My reading of the record is that he did have success in terms of obtaining financial information related to trust administration from the time of Sybil's death forward, correct?
That is correct. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Let me just briefly go through the procedural history of the case. The matter was presented originally to the Honorable Judge Hahn, magistrate.
Sorry, Mr. Storr, if I could interrupt. I'm sorry, I was on mute and didn't get my question out in time. Was the stipulation to stay confirmed by court order?
Yes.
In Arizona? All right, thank you.
Yes. With respect to the procedural history, Judge Hahn ultimately ruled that there was a forfeiture clause in the trust. Ultimately, Judge Hahn ruled that the forfeiture clause was not triggered by the filing of the Arizona petition. However, he also ruled that Mr. Ferguson did not have standing to seek access to trust records with respect to the administration prior to Sybil's death. And that latter ruling is what precipitated an appeal to the district court. The district court reversed on both counts. I might also add that the magistrate also declined to rule on a motion to compel that Mr. Ferguson had filed, again seeking access to those records in order to be able to defend the claim of forfeiture by the trustees.
So, Mr. Storr, my understanding is that subsequent to Sybil's death, there was a property in Bonneville County that was transferred to one of Mr. Ferguson's sisters. And was that done through the trust, or how was that accomplished?
It was not done through the trust. My understanding, it was done by the trustees in their capacity as personal representatives of Sybil's estate.
Is there anything to suggest that that what transpired before Sybil's death was somehow untoward or inappropriate?
Again, we do not know because we do not have access to those records. We do have some significant problems with that transfer because Sybil's one half interest in that transfer should have gone to the Survivors Trust, at least according to our belief, should have gone to the Survivors Trust rather than going directly to Zarissa, who is a trustee. So, but that focuses again upon what we believe is a breach of fiduciary duty. It should have gone to the trust.
So, Mr. Your client, Michael Ferguson, was a contingent beneficiary before Sybil died. Is that correct?
We do not believe it was a contingent beneficiary. I think the correct term is he was a residual beneficiary in the trust. Our belief is that if you look at Idaho Code Section 157303 for the purpose of determining whether or not they are entitled to exercise the duties of the trust, whether it's contingent, future, vested, or not, is not really relevant. So we believe he was a residual beneficiary.
Residual as opposed to statutory? I agree that he was a statutory beneficiary, but I'm not sure that he was more than that.
Well, I'm not sure what the court means by a statutory beneficiary. At least as I look at it, he was a beneficiary both by statute. If you look at the definition of a beneficiary.
That's my definition of a statutory beneficiary.
Yes, so that is correct. There's also a definition of beneficiary in the trust that I think, essentially tracks the statutory definition. So I would say, yes, he is a beneficiary under both.
And do we have case law that says that somebody in Michael Ferguson's position can ask the trust for an accounting before the actual accomplishment of that trust, the fact that he became a beneficiary upon his mother's death?
In terms of the statutory basis, there's a provision in the statute that allows beneficiaries to make a request for a statement of accounts and to they're entitled to information concerning the particulars of the administration.
And you think he was entitled to that before Sybil's death?
No. Or wait a minute, yes. Before her death, but not before she exercised her power of attorney. We do not contend that Mr. Ferguson was a beneficiary prior to the time when she exercised her power of appointment. But before her death, yes, he was a beneficiary before then. Okay, very well. Let me just briefly summarize the district court's ruling. District court reversed, as I mentioned. The magistrate held that the magistrate had erred in holding that Mr. Ferguson had no standing because he was not a beneficiary before Sybil's death. The district court reversed that that conclusion. That conclusion has not been appealed, so that is now, we contend, the law of the case that Mr. Ferguson was a beneficiary before Sybil's death and became a beneficiary at the time that Sybil executed the exercised her power of appointment. The district court, however, also ruled that under the terms of the survivor's trust that Sybil Ferguson owed no duties to either Mr. Ferguson or any of the beneficiaries, and that thereof his filing in Arizona was unreasonable. And we have significant problems with that conclusion that you can even have a trust where there's no duties, and I'll argue that in a moment. The district court also did not consider the magistrate's ruling that the documents were not relevant because Mr. Ferguson was not a beneficiary before Sybil's death. So he did not address the relevant issue, nor did he address the motion to compel. Essentially, the district court ignored that. That also is a very significant error, we believe, as we'll argue. Let me take just a few moments, if I will, and point out what I think are some uncontested facts that are very, very important. There's no dispute that Michael and his sister Debbie were initially disinherited under the 2011 version of the trust. There's no question about that. As I mentioned earlier, there is no question that Mr. Ferguson, Michael, became a beneficiary at the time that Sybil exercised her power of appointment. That results because of the, that is now the law of the case. That issue was not appealed. So once again, there is no question that he was a beneficiary at the time Sybil exercised her power of appointment. Another significant fact, section 1810 of the trust gives all beneficiaries a right of access to, quote, financial records and documentation of the trust. That's very important. The trustee may exclude information that is, quote, not directly applicable to the beneficiary receiving the information. Another matter that is not disputed, the trustees consistently refused to allow Michael access to the Survivors Trust administrative records created prior to Sybil's death. If you look at page 30 on the of the appellant's brief, there's a number of citations in that record or in the brief indicating that that was not disputed. Another significant fact is the original family trust contains a forfeiture clause in section 20.03 of the family trust, which is triggered if the beneficiary files suit on a creditor's claim in a probate. There's no dispute. As I mentioned, Mr. Ferguson filed a petition for allowance of claims in Arizona. That was filed because of his inability to obtain access to administrative records, and it was filed in order to preserve a potential claim against Sybil's estate. As I mentioned earlier, that petition was not pursued. It was stayed by stipulation and by order of the court.
So I want to make sure that I understand your position with regard to that forfeiture position. Forfeiture provision. Are you saying that Michael's filing in Arizona does not trigger the forfeiture provision for some reason, or it does trigger that provision?
We believe it was not triggered. It was not within the contemplation of Sybil that it would be used to allow the trustees to essentially breach their duties. We do not think that was the intent of that forfeiture provision, that it be used in the manner in which it was here.
Okay, so your position would be that the filing is in effect a trigger, but it shouldn't be enforced here because of the discovery dispute.
Yeah, we believe it was essentially it was a placeholder action only. It wasn't pursued. It wasn't in order to engage in what we call Rambo tactics. It was merely to allow the parties or allow Mr. Ferguson to obtain access to the administrative records so he could determine if there was cause. And that's the whole problem with this case, is that the trustees, we contend, reached their duty of allowing access, thereby depriving Mr. Ferguson of the ability to evaluate that claim. So that is correct. We do not believe it falls within the terms of that, of the forfeiture clause.
So Mr. Starr, would you agree that in order to preclude that provision from being triggered, that Michael Ferguson would need probable cause in order to challenge the trust and the administration of the estate?
Yes.
And what probable cause do you have to show that Mr. Ferguson's actions were justified?
Once again, that's the problem, is Mr. Ferguson was deprived of access to administrative records, and therefore, in essence, the trustees had impeded the administration of the estate. He had no ability to look at the administrative records to determine. So, in essence, his inability to ascertain probable cause was frustrated by the trustees' breach of their duties.
So are you conceding that he doesn't have probable cause as he sits here today?
What I'm saying is our ability to make that determination was impeded by what the trustees did. There are, if you look at the affidavit of Mr. Ferguson, there are numerous transactions, occurrences that certainly give rise to some question as to what happened. But without access to the administrative records, you cannot determine exactly what is the reason why essentially many assets were missing. So once again, it gets back to the breach of their duties.
So you suggest there are facts that suggest that the trustees or Sybil didn't do her job, or that the trustees haven't done their job?
That's correct.
And what are those facts?
Well, if you look at the affidavit of Mr. Ferguson, you will see there are a number of very questionable transactions. There are a number of assets that were missing. We don't know if that was because they were put into the deceased grantor's share improperly. Again, it was community property. And that's the whole problem, is we do not know how that allocation was made. But to answer your question directly, Mr. Ferguson's inability to present probable cause was precipitated by the trustee's refusal to grant him his entitlement to review trust records under Section 1810 of the trust, as well as Section 15-7-303.
Speaking of probable cause, what is the source, if you will, of that exception to the enforcement of a forfeiture provision in a trust in Idaho?
There is nothing in Idaho in the statute with respect to trusts. There is, however, a very parallel provision in the probate code relative to wills. So we contend that with respect to trusts, it should be likewise imposed by reference to common law restatement.
And as far as the common law goes, I understand the restatement provision, but talk to me a little bit about the common law and to what extent we have a body of case law that actually supports the position that's set forth in the restatement.
To my knowledge, there is not any Idaho case law on that issue. There is a significant number of cases in other jurisdictions which have followed the requirement of reasonable cause. All of those are cited in our brief. Okay, well, very good. Let me then just get quickly to our argument. Let's see, I don't see our clock here.
Sir, it's on your video. And you're into your rebuttal time.
Yeah, I see that now. I think just to summarize very, very quickly, the argument is essentially this, if you want to really get down to it. This whole case is precipitated by the trustees' breach of their duties under 1810 and under 15703. That's the heart of this case, is you cannot use a forfeiture clause to facilitate a breach of their own duties. And that's the essence of this case. You'll see there's significant problems we have with the district court's finding of a trust with no duties. I think that renders the trust illusory. It's also inconsistent with the many duties in both the trust and the statute. And that's all based on the court's conclusion that Sybil's power to invade the trust corpus overrode all of those duties. I don't interpret that. I think that's an incorrect interpretation. There are duties as long as there are assets in the trust. And again, we've inserted that as error. There's significant authority. So I think long and short of what, in conclusion, our belief is that the matter should be remanded to the district court. Mr. Ferguson should be given an opportunity to pursue discovery to allow him to defend against the claim by the trustees that the forfeiture was appropriate. Again, he was deprived of the ability to pursue discovery, if you will, and that the forfeiture should not be examined or should be become applicable if and only if Mr. Ferguson pursues that stayed action. So it's just premature. That's really what we're saying, is that it's premature. We don't need to reach that issue for the purposes of this case. The only question that should be involved here is whether or not Mr. Ferguson was entitled to access to trust administrative records. We do not need to reach the forfeiture issue, if you will. It's simply premature. And for that reason, we would urge this court to reverse and remand to the district court.
Thank you. And by the way, I was remiss. Obviously, Justice Mohler is not a party to this action. And he's been replaced by our senior justice, Joel Horton, who will participate fully in the matter. On behalf of the respondent, Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Your Honor. I represent the trustees in this case. There are just a few things related to the facts that I would like to clarify as we go about. One is it's important to understand the nature of this trust that was first established. When Roger and Sybil Ferguson established the trust, most of the combined assets of their estates were included in it. It is a revocable trust. It was an inter vivos trust, a type commonly used in estate planning in place of the disposition provisions in a will, although usually you have what's called a pour over will to go along with that to catch any assets that have not been transferred to the trust during the lifetimes of the grantors. Upon the death of the first grantor to die, in this case it was Roger, then the trust divided into two parts, but further, the deceased grantor's share was divided again into another two trusts. So you, in essence, had three sub-trusts created upon the death of the first grantor to die. The survivor's trust held the community property interest and the separate property of the surviving grantor, and then the assets of the community property interest and separate property interest of the deceased grantor were divided among two separate trusts. One that we refer to as the family trust, and the other is the marital trust. That kind of division is accomplished primarily for tax planning purposes. The assets in the family trust are designed to remain out of the combined estate of the two grantors upon the second death, so that when the estate tax return is filed, the assets in that family trust are not included. And that's the primary purpose for that kind of a structure when you're dealing with estate planning trusts such as these. The trust, when it's established and it's revocable and used very widely and well known for many purposes, is not even regarded as a trust. For example, for income tax purposes, that living trust doesn't file a separate income tax return. All of the attributes are reported on the returns of the grantors. For purposes of the property tax exemption, it's treated as though the residence, even though it's been transferred to a trust, is still the property of the grantors, and the existence of it is disregarded for those purposes. That's because the grantors retain control over all of the assets and can revoke the trust at any time. They can transfer assets in and out freely as they want to. Now, upon Roger's death, when the survivor trust was came into being and was allocated, and it was all of these were governed by the same document, the document that was signed in 2011. Then the trust that contained Sybil's share of the community property and her separate property was the survivor trust. She retained broad power over the assets in that trust. She could use them for any purpose. She could withdraw whatever she wanted. She also had a general power of appointment, and it's important to understand what that power of appointment was. It was a testamentary power. It would only be effective upon her death. It wasn't a power to amend or change the terms of the trust, but it was a power that allowed her to override the dispositive provisions of just the survivor trust, her share on her side, and to direct that whatever assets remained in that trust upon her death go to whomever she desired to direct that they go to. So in other words, she could appoint that anyone receive the assets in that survivor's trust upon her death.
So does that alter the status? Someone that receives through the exercise of that power of appointment receives a trust asset, does that, are they not a beneficiary of the trust? Do they have some other status?
Well, I think that you could give them various names. You could call them appointee.
I'm sorry, you cut out there for a moment.
You could refer to a person in that position as an appointee, as opposed to a beneficiary. But I think for the purposes that we're talking about today, it doesn't really matter. One of the things that is important to understand is whatever interest that individual has is a contingent interest. It does not vest, it does not come into being until the surviving grantor passes away, because the survivor always retains the right to change what they've done to designate that power of appointment or to exercise it. In this case, Sybil signed a new will after her husband's death and before she passed away. And under that will, she included language to exercise the power of appointment, and that language directed that a portion of what was in the survivor's trust would go to Mike.
So I want to make sure that we have the right vocabulary in terms of talking about this case and what Michael's status was. Michael calls himself a residual beneficiary. Is that an accurate description of his position or not?
I'm not sure what that actually means, Your Honor. To the extent that he takes the position that he was not a contingent beneficiary, I would argue with that, because I think his interest was very much contingent. It could have changed at any time before his mother's death.
Okay, so articulate for me exactly what your client's position is in terms of Michael's status. What is the right legal label to ascribe to him?
If I were putting the label on it, I would say that he was an appointee under that power of appointment by virtue of the language in his mother's will. But again, I'm not sure for the purposes of this case that it makes a big difference, because the focus needs to be on whatever rights he had at particular periods of time. And his rights before Sybil died were much different from any rights that he had after she passed away. And I think that's where we come down to the real crux of the dispute in this case, is whether or not the fact that he was named as an appointee under the power of appointment gave him rights to go back to any time before her death and require an accounting of what she did in her capacity as a trustee during her lifetime, when she was the only beneficiary who had any kind of present interest.
Upon her death, did he become a beneficiary of the trust?
Yes. By virtue of her exercise of the power of appointment, we have no dispute with that.
Okay.
In fact, that's why my clients provided financial information both before and after the petition that Mike filed for an accounting. They provided information about all of the trust from the time, the survivor's trust from the time of Sybil's death onward, the period during which they were the trustees, but Mike is not satisfied with that.
So, Mr. Taylor, doesn't the statute specifically give Michael Ferguson the status of a beneficiary prior to Sybil's death?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Isn't that what former judge, now Justice Mohler, determined?
I don't think he did it on the basis of the statute. I do think that he said that that Michael was a beneficiary. I do not think that confers any retroactive rights on him for the time before Sybil died.
You would agree that you haven't appealed that determination by Judge Mohler?
We have no reason to appeal it, Your Honor. And I would mention that this court, because Judge Mohler ruled in our favor in saying that there were no fiduciary duties that Sybil had for him, and that's the proper focus of any inquiry. So it really doesn't matter whether you call him a contingent beneficiary or whether you call him an appointee. The focus is, whatever his position was, what kind of rights did he have? And did he have rights to go back and ask for an accounting retroactive to the date of his father's death? And make no mistake about it, that is what he has requested. All of the pleadings and all of the documentation go back clear to the date of his father's death. And that's what
man. Let's just assume for purposes of my question that on the subsequent to Roger's death, the trust misapplied the criteria and put more money in the family trust than it should have, and that the survivor's trust was given short shrift as far as what it should have had in it. Should a beneficiary, such as Michael, be able to know whether the money was correctly attributed to the right trust when it was attributed to that trust?
A beneficiary in Michael's position has no right or duty to, with respect to that allocation, Your Honor.
Even assuming that it was incorrect and shouldn't have been made up.
Even if it was not done correctly, it still did not affect his interests and his rights because Sybil had the right to use all of the assets and do whatever she wanted with all of the assets in that survivor's trust. And she had no obligation to Mike or to any of the other beneficiaries who were named to keep any particular assets or any amount of assets. She could have withdrawn all of them and created a new trust if she wanted. She could have withdrawn all of them and just put together a new will if she wanted. She had complete and full discretion, and none of them had any vested interest into any amount that arose prior to her death. And because of that, she had no duties to any of them with respect to this. Now, the district court correctly said that if this court or if any other court were to find otherwise or rule otherwise, we'd be standing on its head. Years of law, decades of law, centuries of law related to the freedom of disposition of people with their own assets and what they're going
to do. But this is not her own asset at this point. It's the asset of a trust.
They were her own assets in the sense and the type of asset of the trust that this was, because this was an inter vivos revocable trust. And one of the reasons that she had such broad discretion with respect to these is because this was her share of the estate. She didn't have the same kind of discretion with respect to the family trust or the marital trust that contained the assets of her husband after he died, but she had that discretion with respect to her own. And that's an important distinction. As you think about what we do for estate planning purposes with these kinds of trusts, and when she and Roger set this trust up, she didn't relinquish her ability to control those assets or to deal with those assets. Now, if you say otherwise in this case, then you are in essence saying that whenever parents or a parent use this tool of a revocable living trust for their assets as an estate planning tool, from the moment they set up the trust and include their children as contingent beneficiaries, that then they have to account to their children for what they do with the assets during the rest of their lifetimes. And I don't think that's what we want to do in the law. And I don't think there is any law anywhere that supports that view of things. Michael's interest was not he had no present interest in the trust before Sybil's death. None. His interest only came to fruition and only ripened at the point in time at which she passed away. And from that point on, he may have had some rights that he could enforce. Now,
let's assume that the trustees gave one of Sybil's houses to the remaining siblings, which is one of the allegations, after Sybil's death. Do you think that was capable of being done under the documents that existed at the time, the trust or the will?
Important to distinguish here. First of all, they've made no allegation that the trustees in their capacity as trustees transferred property outside of what the trust allowed. And that's important to note. What Mr. Storer was talking about and what they have alleged, well, I'm not even going to say allege what they have suggested, because there has been no evidence submitted on any of the issues about those kinds of things. They've made no specific allegations about the trustees. What they have suggested is that under the probate, where three of these trustees are also personal representatives, co-personal representatives in the Arizona probate, that there was something there that they think might have been inappropriate, but they don't know anything about it. I will tell you that if they had any evidence that the trustees transferred property that they shouldn't have transferred to someone else outside of the terms of the trust, and they did it after Sybil's death, then that's something that that Michael would have had the right to pursue in the proceeding in Idaho. And he could have gone after that. If he is alleging that Sybil transferred her interest and she did an inappropriate transfer before her death, I think he has absolutely no complaint, because the trust itself gave her the right to transfer any property out of the trust up to the time of her death. She had the ability and the right to do that. She had the ability to make gifts. She had the ability to deal with the property however she wanted to deal with it.
Could she ignore the trust? That is to say, upon Roger's death, decide not to fund the survivor's trust at all?
You know, she actually, when you look at it, she had the right, if she wanted to, she might have had to go through a legal step, but she had the right, if she wanted to take all of the property out of the survivor's trust after Roger's death.
But she had an obligation to put all of her, to put the property specified by the original trust into the survivor's trust.
The survivor's trust provided for a division, an allocation of all of the trust assets. And a portion of those, her portion of those, were to go into the survivor's trust. That is correct. And that allocation was done. Now, that allocation doesn't say, and the trust document doesn't say, these particular assets go in. That allocation gets done on the basis of value.
So if she failed to split the trust to properly follow the original trust provisions regarding the property that goes into the survivor's trust, do the children, and I mean all of them, have any cause of action against their mother?
And I mean all of the children, and the answer is no, because she could have, once the division was made, she could have taken all of the assets right back out.
Now, the question is, though, if she failed to make the proper division,
then there's no harm to the children, because they did not have a vested interest or a present interest in any of the assets in the trust or any amount of property in the trust.
Okay, so the answer would be she had a fiduciary duty to follow the terms of the original trust, place the assets in, but because she could take them out, there's no harm to the children.
I think it is correct that there's no harm to the children. I'm not sure that it even amounts to a fiduciary duty, because her only duty would have been to herself, and I guess to her husband's estate, but it didn't make a difference to her husband's estate. And if something, you know, if it doesn't make a difference, then what is the duty that is owed? That's an allocation that is done for estate planning purposes. Let's say she did that and she was only harming herself because the other trusts had some kind of strings on them. Now, they were there for her benefit, but they had some kind of strings and a few controls on them that the survivor's trust didn't have. So if she did it and it was to her own detriment and she's the only beneficiary of the survivor's trust, and she was the only current income beneficiary, particularly at that time, then has she breached a duty to herself? Does she have a duty, a fiduciary duty to herself? And I'm not sure that the law supports that kind of notion. In effect, that's what the that's what the petitioner has to argue for, is that there is some kind of a duty like that. But I'm not sure that the law really supports the notion that that is a fiduciary duty under the circumstances. And so I would be reluctant to say, yes, it's a fiduciary duty. Now, should she do it that way? I mean, that's the way the trust was set up. But if she doesn't, who has she breached a duty to? To herself? And that's where it would be in this particular situation. It does not flow through to any of the contingent beneficiaries and any of the children, because it doesn't, there is no harm to any of them, and there's no duty to any of them in the particular situation.
And since we were talking about all of the siblings, once Sybil exercised the power of appointment through her will and named Michael, are the children all on equal footing? Do they all have the same status, at least as relates to this sub-trust?
Well, it depends, Your Honor, it depends on the particular circumstances. Sybil exercised the power of appointment to dispose of all of the assets that would remain in the survivor's trust, not just the share that would go to Michael. So there is a, now in this particular case, there happens to be overlap between the beneficiaries who were named in the trust document, who would have received if she didn't exercise the power of appointment, or if she only partially exercised the power of appointment, and the group that she did direct the assets to go to under the power of appointment. And so, depending on which role you look at, they may not have received the same amounts. If you're asking about did they have the same rights, were they on equal footing with respect to the rights that they argued for or that they had, my answer would be in this particular, for purposes of our case right now, that the rights were the same, and that is that they had none. Now, for other purposes, there might be a distinction between people who are named as contingent beneficiaries in the trust document and those who are just appointees under the power of appointment that might be exercised under a will. I haven't done a lot of research on that because it's not particularly relevant to our case today, because I think that they are on the same footing with respect to rights under this trust, and that is that none of them do. We've never argued that the beneficiaries, their contingent beneficiaries under this trust, had any greater rights than Michael with respect to an accounting for Sybil's actions as a trustee before her death. We've never taken that position, and it's kind of interesting that the other side tries to make something of it, because I don't even think it's relevant for purposes of this case. None of them had that right, and none of them would have thought to assert it except for Michael. Okay, couple of other things that I would like to mention. One of them is to clarify the filing with the probate court. Now, Michael's counsel has argued that one of the purposes for filing with the probate court was to try to get access to the records. And I would say that that's just not correct. The filing in the probate court didn't have anything to do with gaining access to the records from the time before Sybil's death. That issue was raised in the Idaho action. And that issue is one that Michael could pursue and is still pursuing in the Idaho action. There's only one reason for the filing of the claim in the probate court. The reason for the filing of that claim was to take one step forward to assert a breach of fiduciary duty against Sybil, his mother, with respect to her conduct as a trustee for periods of time before her death, before Michael's interest ripened. That's the only reason for the filing of that claim in the probate court.
It preserves a remedy, doesn't it?
It preserves a remedy if there is a breach of fiduciary duty, but it isn't, the remedy isn't the access to the records. The remedy is asserting a breach of fiduciary duty claim against his mother.
Right. This action is all about access to the records, and then filing down in Arizona was so that if in fact he's successful here, then he has some ability to reach assets outside of this trust.
That is correct, Your Honor. And so, but it's don't make no mistake that that action was necessary to get access to the records. It was just to preserve the breach of fiduciary duty claim that he claims that he has against his mother. And I think that's important to understand. The trustees didn't do anything to force him to file that claim down there. They didn't do that to be able to hide the records. There's nothing circular going on with any of that kind of thing. It's an interesting thing. The forfeiture provision in this case that we talk about, it has no language creating any kind of an exception or carve out for probable cause. The forfeiture provision is very straightforward. It says, if you do these things, and it expresses the intent of the grantors, if anybody does these things, they no longer receive any benefit from any of the trusts. Now, it's interesting to note in this case, besides the filing in the probate court, Michael now, in this matter, is arguing that the forfeiture provision should be void as against public policy.
I heard him argue that it was premature, that the filing of, or excuse me, that the application of the forfeiture provision at this point would be, it's just too early.
He did say that, but his briefs use the word void as against public policy, and that is one of the main arguments. When he talks about an exculpatory provision with respect to a trustee, they are asking that the provision be held void as against public policy. I would note that one of the other triggers in the forfeiture provision in this case, Clause B, is any beneficiary taking the position that any portion of the trust document or any of the other documents, any provision is void. So besides the filing in the probate court, which clearly triggers the forfeiture provision, you've got now an argument in this proceeding that a provision of the trust document is void, which is a second trigger for the forfeiture provision. So there is no exception in the language that says that if the proceeding in the probate court is stayed, that then it's not a forfeiture. Michael hasn't withdrawn his petition in the probate court. It's still there. He's prepared to move forward with it if he finds anything that he thinks will be a breach of fiduciary duty. And you can bet your bottom dollar that he'll use whatever he can to go forward with that to increase his benefit if it is not forfeited and if he is allowed to get an accounting that goes back to the time when his father passed away. If the court says, yeah, there is a fiduciary duty and he's entitled to all of this, if it's reversed, you know, we'll be going on with that issue for a long time. The language in the trust is clear. It expresses the grantor's intent. I guess the question for this court is how important is the intent of the grantor under Idaho law? In our mind, the case law supports the notion that the grantor's intent is paramount. And as a court, you've got the ability to decide. I mean, there are alternative theories or arguments for supporting the enforcement of the forfeiture clause in this particular case. We argued, or I shouldn't say argued, we briefed, referenced in our brief, the case from Wyoming. Wyoming has taken the position that probable cause is not an exception. If it's not in the language of the forfeiture provision in Wyoming, even if there is probable cause, we're still going to enforce the forfeiture provision. And that's because we give such great weight to the grantor's intent. We're not going to say that the grantor has to be fair, that they have to be smart, that they have to be wise. That's not our judgment to make. And in the absence of legislative action to put a probable cause provision in place, Wyoming has said no probable cause in our state. Now, not all of the states take the same position. Some of them have probable cause exceptions. Idaho doesn't have any case law on that. But in this particular
case, at this time, sir, if I might, at this time you're going past your allotted time. I do have one question, however, and that is you've indicated that the question here is to as to whether or not Idaho will, in fact, follow the grantor's intent in the trust documents. Could the question in fact be rephrased to be whether or not Idaho has any interest in the time-honored issue of the fiduciary duty of the trustees of these trusts? It seems to me that your argument would in fact vitiate any and all of that fiduciary duty to the language of the trusts.
Your Honor, my response to that would be that the grantors of the trust have great latitude in providing in the trust document what the parameters of the fiduciary duties are going to be, and that there are many occasions in which Idaho law recognizes that the creators of either of a trust, or I think of the cases of limited liability companies, where the creators have the freedom to alter fiduciary duties that might otherwise be listed under statutes by virtue of the agreement that they make among themselves. And so I think there is very much precedent for being able to modify and restrict and limit those fiduciary duties. Now, I think it's too broad to say that they have the right to necessarily to vitiate all fiduciary duties. I don't know that that's the case, but I don't think that's the case that we have before us today. I think the focus here is what kind of duties are you going to impose on the grantors and trustees of revocable living trusts who use those documents as a way to allocate their own assets upon their deaths? What kind of duties are you going to impose upon them for the period of time before they die? And what kinds of restrictions are you going to put in place? And we don't believe there should be any.
Thank you, sir. And your time is up, and appreciate the answer. How much time does the appellant have?
6 minutes, Your Honor.
Sir.
Mr. Story, you're on mute.
Mr. Story, you're on mute. Can't hear you.
Is that better?
Yes. Start his time now, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a couple of quick points. It's important to remember that upon the death of the first grantor, the trust became irrevocable. So there's no ability to alter the duties of the trust. It's an irrevocable trust at that point.
But Sybil could have spent every dollar in the survivor's trust, and your client would have no claim to any amount as a beneficiary under her estate.
That's correct. We would agree. But that doesn't render the trust illusory. As long as there's money in the trust, she has those fiduciary duties. Let me come back to a quickly.
So Mr. Taylor says that the duties were owed to Sybil And she couldn't breach a duty to herself. How do you respond to that?
I don't agree with that because it results in the argument that the survivor's trust is illusory. In other words, she owes no duties whatsoever. I don't agree with that very strongly.
To whom is the duty owed?
To the beneficiaries of the trust. And that gets really to the point I want to make next. It pertains primarily to both your question as well as Justice Brody. Let's be clear about the nature of the duties owed to beneficiaries. The teaching of 15.1.203 is that in terms of the duties owed to the beneficiaries, a beneficiary is a beneficiary is a beneficiary. It doesn't matter. So those duties are not contingent. And that's the point that I think you need to recognize. Those duties are not contingent. Granted, the dispositive share is contingent upon whether or not there's money left in the trust, but the duties owed to beneficiaries is not contingent. That's the teaching of 15.1-2033, the beneficiary is beneficiary. Now, the respondent is effectively arguing that, well, we can just ignore the survivor's trust because there was no duties. Well, that renders the survivor's trust illusory. And that's the problem with their argument. Because of the discretion that Sybil had, they're essentially saying, yeah, we could ignore the survivor's trust. It's illusory. She owed duties to herself. In essence, their argument is, the survivor's trust did not exist. We can ignore it. That is not consistent with their intent. The intent was to establish a survivor's trust so that if there was money left in the trust, that would go to the beneficiaries of those trusts. So that survivor's trust is not illusory, and that's the argument that the respondents are making. Now, we can ignore the survivor's trust because the duties were owed to Sybil. We don't agree with that at all. Let me quickly get to, Mr. Taylor argues there's no allegation made of any breach of duties. At this point, that's correct. And the reason for that is they would not provide us with the trust administrative records. That's the crux of the matter. They breached their duties. So there's an inability to determine not only with respect to Sybil's breach, but also with respect to their own. They would not give us records relating to the administration of the trust. That's why that allegation was not made. They argue that the Arizona action was not really a placeholder action. Well, that's just simply not true. The Arizona action was precipitated by their breach. That's the reason why the placeholder was necessary. They would not provide the administrative records by which the Mr. Ferguson could determine if there was a breach. That's the point of the matter. So lastly, let me just again reemphasize the point that I think overrides all of this. It's simply premature. Mr. Ferguson should have been entitled to pursue discovery on the reasonable cause issue. That discovery was given the axe, if you will, because of the ruling of the district court. He declined to consider the motion to compel. So Mr. Ferguson should have been given discovery to pursue the reasonable cause in response to the very issue that was raised by the trustees. And so again, the question is whether or not it is premature. The court need not address the forfeiture issue, if you will, until Mr. Ferguson, if and when he pursues the Arizona action. It's just simply premature at this point, and the court merely should remand back to the magistrate, allow discovery, allow Mr. Ferguson to determine, as he's entitled to, after he's given the records, whether or not the trust has been administered properly. He's been deprived of that right.
During what time periods are you arguing that he has the right to these records? It's been alleged clear back to the death of the husband, as opposed, it seemed to me, you were arguing from the time of the reintroduction of Michael into the trust?
The question in that regard is relevance. If you look at both the statute as well as the provision in the will, it's relevant. It's relevant to the determination of his share. So that's the reason why we need the records. So it has nothing to do with his interest in the trust. It's relevance to his share.
So you're asking clear back to the death of the father?
Back to the time of the allocation. That's really the issue. We are entitled to determine if the allocation was done properly. And that's the starting point for Mr. Ferguson to be able to determine what his share is.
You would define point of allocation as what?
Upon Roger's death, Sybil had the duty to allocate as between the grantor's, deceased grantor's share and the survivor's trust.
Very good.
Well, thank you very much.
I see that your time, did someone have another question? I'm sorry. Let's see, the time is up. Thank you, folks. At this point in time, the matter is under advisement. We will render a decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.